Paragon Referral CPD Podcast. Today's topic, ophthalmology in general practice.
Hello and welcome to the latest in a series of Paragon Referrals CPD Podcasts. My name's Guy Killick and joining me today is James Rushton, head of the ophthalmic service here at Paragon.
Hello Guy, nice to see you again.
Nice to see you as well. So, ophthalmology, to many a GP at any stage of their career, it's a field of a lot of mystery. It's we're all very used to kind of dealing with corneal ulcers, conjunctivitis, any kind of general red eye. But beyond that, it's a bit, you know, it's curing the blind, as it were, I think you said earlier today. So the eye is a very delicate structure. We're a bit afraid because it's very much outside our comfort zone. It's not covered that well at university either. So hopefully the aim of the podcast today is to kind of have a bit of a relaxed overview of ophthalmology from both a GP's and a specialist view, and to see what's possible from a first opinion perspective, what can be achieved at referral level, as well as try and relieve some of those fears and stresses and handling those cases yourself at home. So I think the best thing to do is actually just start off with a topic. What do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Yeah.
Corneal ulcers?
Corneal ulcers, yeah.
Corneal ulcers, yeah. Fantastic. Everyday sort of case.
Yeah, so I think probably 95% of all ulcer cases are being treated by first opinion vets, as you probably alluded to already. The cases that we tend to see are sort of the select cases which either haven't responded to treatment or have deteriorated quite quickly. In terms of sort of first opinion treatment, I think they're doing a great job already, to be fair. I mean, we rarely ever see anything that didn't need referral. I think what I'd probably say as a top tip is to sometimes you want to refer earlier rather than later, or at least offer referral earlier rather than later. Very few people have ever complained to be referred unnecessarily, but people do oftentimes say, would this have happened if I had been referred earlier? I think that's the first thing to do, is to actually offer the client referral early on. Probably indolent ulcers are one of the types of ulcers which are most frustrating both to GP vets as well as to us. With these sort of ulcers, your classic cases like a 8-year-old Westie who's had an ulcer for a couple of weeks time, that it's been changed on antibiotics multiple times, hasn't responded to any kind of treatment, and then they start doing multiple debridements. Sometimes GP vets feel comfortable doing grid keratotomies or algorithms. And oftentimes I see those cases, you know, several months down the line, you know, after multiple attempts of treatment, and they still haven't healed. And then you've got a frustrated owner, obviously, you know, naturally as you can expect, the dog probably won't tolerate eye drops anymore. And then you sort of have to start thinking about the more invasive treatment options, things like keratectomies or microsurgical grid keratotomies, or this type of thing. I think the most serious types of ulcers that we tend to deal with is brachycephalics, and they make my toenails curl sometimes if they come in. So if you have an ulcer in a pug or in a shih tzu or in a Lhasa Apso, don't treat it as you would if you had a Cocker Spaniel or a Westie, because they will behave very differently. They tend to have very exposed eyes. They don't tend to blink very well. They tend to have poor lid conformation, and because of their nasal folds, which are just right next door to the eye, that does harbor a lot of Pseudomonas. So they do tend to get horrible Pseudomonas infections very quickly. So I have seen ulcers in pugs go from very superficial to complete corneal ruptures within hours. So they are horrible.
Bloody hell, that doesn't kind of like fall into our theme of trying to make people relax. No, it's absolutely no. I was always kind of going through kind of basic CPD from places like from reps and things. They very much push lubrication as part of the treatment protocol now for ulcers. Mm-hmm. I imagine that's much more important than these brachies because they can't close their eyes as easily. Is that
absolutely right? Yeah. The one thing I would say is that whatever these types of lubrications, whether it's Remend or Viscal or whatever these are, don't think that they're sole treatments. They are a very good or a very important add-on to the treatment that we need, but I wouldn't solely rely on those. I tend to, brachydephalics, I tend to switch to fluoroquinolones very quickly. Ideally, you should take cultures early on before switching to fluoroquinolones. But with brachycephalics, oftentimes I don't have the time to wait for the culture results. So I will still take a culture, but I will switch them to fluoroquinolones very, very quickly, even if the culture result hasn't come back yet, because, like I said, they can deteriorate quite quickly. The other thing is, nowadays we tend to have more advanced treatment options for ulcers. So especially your sort of classic melting ulcer in a shih tzu, we tend to use a device called corneal cross-linking, which is an excellent device, which has saved many an eye and not required any surgery after that. It's sort of a combination of using riboflavin eye drops and then a specialized UV light to stabilize the cornea and trying to disinfect it. There's also more sort of devices coming to the market with the aim of sterilizing the cornea without having to rely on heavy antibiotic use. But in the worst case scenario, you know, we might have to resolve to surgical treatment options, corneal grafting procedures, conjunctival graft, all of those kinds of things, which is probably beyond the scope of this short podcast. But yeah, again, just going back to some of those invasive treatment options could be avoided if referral were offered earlier rather than later.
Okay, okay. So, for example, I've got a pug coming in. Owner complaining it's been rubbing its eye, seems rather sort of swollen. Comes in, fluorescein lights up like a Christmas tree. At that point, obviously, I'm going to be starting possibly chlorpheniclone, Remend, possibly a extra lubrication to be given there as well. At that point, should we kind of be mentioning, look, pugs have got a predisposition to go nasty very quickly? I want you to come back in the next 24 hours for a recheck, and 24 hours after that, just to make sure it's healing. But at any point at this stage, we may need to consider sending you to a specialist, because these eyes can go bad very quickly. So is it important, you think, to have that kind of conversation quite early on with the owner?
Absolutely, yeah. I think it's much easier to set their expectations low and say that this can go bad very quickly. I will have that conversation with any brachy owner very early, rather than say it's going to be a straightforward ulcers, it's going to heal quite quickly, and then having to go back and say, actually, this is not doing what we were expecting it to do. So I think the client needs to be educated that this could potentially go wrong very quickly.
Awesome.
Absolutely. The only thing I would probably add into your treatment plan is I tend to put all of them on serum.
Yep.
Or Stromiase, which is sort of the new product launched by TVM. Both of those have anti-melting properties, so we call those metalloproteinases. And both of those will try and stop a corneal melt from developing if it's not already happened.
Absolutely, no. Serum drops is something that's really easy to do in general practice. Yeah. It is just a rather big blood sample. Spin it down into a few blood tubes. You can tell the owner to freeze. If you get five tubes, tell the owner to freeze four of them at home. Use one for 2 days and then defrost another. And then you've got kind of a good week's worth there just to be working on with.
A good top tip is you don't have to use that dog's own serum. You can use any dog's serum. And you can also cross species. So if you've got a horse in the backyard, you can drain that horse and spin it down and use that for a dog.
Now, obviously, kind of moving away from ulcers here, when we come to refer to you guys, one of the kind of biggest fears from our side is also just looking a bit stupid. We want to kind of give you guys a kind of good report when we go in. We kind of, you know, it's that kind of, we kind of want you to be impressed by what we've done so far. What when you get any sort of ophthalmic referral in, any request in, what diagnostic procedures would you like to have done beforehand? What can we send to you on top of just a written history? What would be your ideal referral request come in you know, your model, yeah. model one.
So just going back to ulcer referrals, I'm really impressed whenever I have a referral and they've actually done cytology and cultures. I think that's a really, really good asset to have, because that's something that we would do straight away. And if we've already got that information, if we know that we are dealing with a Pseudomonas or staph or strep infection, then we can take that into consideration, and then we can make a clinical judgment based on that. In terms of other referrals, so say for instance cataracts, I think it is very useful. I think most practices do that anyway, but to find out is this a diabetic dog, yes or no, is it a stable diabetic dog, and to get a little bit more clinical information in terms of things like PLRs, dazzle responses, those sorts of things, just to see whether there's any indication that the retina might not be working, because that can have a big influence whether he's going to go and have cataract surgery, yes or no. A big thing that I keep on getting from first opinion vets is when they make a referral for, say, for instance, diabetic cataract, is that they're worried about them not being stable at the time of having surgery. I don't tend to worry about that too much. I will operate them even if they're not completely stable, because the anesthetic will knock that diabetes off a little bit anyway. And I'd much rather have an eye that can see quickly rather than having to risk a lens rupture, which could happen if you leave the cataract for too long. So I think that's one of the most important things. And that's probably also one of the biggest complaints from clients if they come to see us, if the dogs have had cataracts for many, many months before they came to see us, and the eyes at that point might be beyond repair. And then the big question that usually comes up is, well, could we have done something had it been referred sooner? So I don't tend to really comment on that. It's I think it's impossible really to comment on that. But I think that's a conversation that should be done fairly early in the diagnosis, that almost every diabetic will develop cataracts within a year after diagnosis.
So right from the start, when we kind of along with kind of giving the Kel insulin and the needles, we need to be saying, look, we need to keep a very close eye on these eyes.
Mm-hmm.
Any sort of cloudiness you notice, any sort of, if you're concerned about his sight at all, tell us immediately, because we need to act on that as soon as possible. Because, you know, sight is a major part of the senses to dogs, even though they do rely on their nose quite a lot. Sight is still a major quality of life improver. So, you know, we're always talking about quality of life at the end of the day with any treatment plan. It's going to affect it quite severely. So it's going to, and at the end of the day, a animal of a good quality of life will equal a happy owner at the end of the day too.
Absolutely. And I'd probably just add into that, rather than just telling the owner to watch for any opacities, every time you see them back for a glucose curve, or just pick up your thermoscope, have a quick look into the eye, even just from a distance, so you get a nice retroillumination from the back of the eye. And if that starts becoming very cloudy or hazy, look closely and see if there's anything like cataract going on. And if so, offer referral early on.
Absolutely. So anything else that we can do from kind of the first opinion side, kind of like when it arrives, you go, God, I wish they'd done this before it arrived, apart from just get it to you sooner.
Yeah. I think the one thing I'd probably want to mention, especially on a podcast here, is cherry eyes. I don't know why. Since I've moved up here from the southwest, I'm doing way less cherry eye surgeries than I have done before, and I do see quite a lot of cases coming in with dry bulldogs in particular, who've had a history of cherry eye removal early on in the disease process. And I just wanted to point out that if you have a case of cherry eye, don't just jump into removing those. Do offer the client that there is such a thing as referral for cherry eye surgery if you don't feel comfortable doing it yourself, because the owner needs to have that, needs to make that choice themselves, whether they're happy to risk developing treatment resistant dry eye if you remove the third eyelid gland, or having it surgically repaired, which has got a much better outcome. So the success rate of cherry eye surgery is about 80 to 95% roughly. The other thing is, if you're not comfortable doing cherry eye surgery, it's much better to offer referral straight away, because it is, although it's not a particularly difficult procedure, there are a few things that you need to be aware of. And if you haven't done them or you don't feel comfortable with them, your success rate will not be as good. So I'm very impressed if I get a referral for a cherry eye which has not been attempted once or twice before if that particular referring vet is not comfortable doing that procedure. If you're comfortable doing it and it relapses, that's fine. But if you've not really done it before, it's not the kind of surgery that you would want to try on a clinical patient.
I think that falls into cherry eye surgery falls into kind of a series of surgeries that we, as a first opinion vet, you feel like you should be able to do, even if you're not confident in it. And I think it is that fear of appearing stupid if you do send it off to somebody else to be done, that it's going to arrive and you're going to have a team of ophthalmologists go, oh bloody hell, why have they sent us this? They could have done this themselves. We're busy enough as it is. But I think it's that kind of, we need to kind of, discussing it in a form like this where we can say, no, it's absolutely fine. Send it. If you're not comfortable, send it. It's the surgeries you're more comfortable in are going to be the ones with the better outcomes. If you're uncomfortable, the chances are it's not going to have a good outcome. You're setting yourself up for failure from the beginning.
Yeah. But if it makes everybody feel happier, I'm more nervous doing a cherry eye surgery than doing a ruptured eye or a difficult cataract, because cherry eye surgery is very much like a spay or a neuter. Nobody cares if you do it right. If you bugger it up, you do look a little bit silly, particularly if you are in a referral center and they reprolapse. So I'm very open with my clients that even though they have been sent to the specialist, it can recur even in my hands. So I wouldn't worry about that too much. But yes, it is I think underestimated how much can potentially go wrong if you don't do a good job of it.
Fantastic. Now, with eyes as well, it's very, while in general practice we do hear about cross-licking occasionally, cataract surgery, what other surgeries are there available at the referral level that do make a massive improvement to quality of life? We all joke about ophthalmology, but it is making the blind see the kind of slightly biblical connotations around it. But, what can you guys do to cases that, any degenerative diseases, anything that we tend to see on a day-to-day, we might see on a day-to-day basis and think there's nothing that can really be done, it's just old age, it's just a continuation of that chronic disease. What can be done here at a facility like Paragon that can really, really improve that quality of life?
Yeah, so I think, we cover most sort of aspects, apart from retinal reattachment surgery, we do cover most aspects of ophthalmic surgery. I think one of the things that we do, which most first opinion practices will almost certainly not do, is surgery for degenerative corneal disease. So there are some procedures that you can do to try and clear up that really blue, cloudy cornea. As we already talked about, corneal cross-linking, which is a very handy device, a very, very good technique to have to try and sort out very superficial ulcers, which might not need surgery, if it's too large for the cornea to have any sort of transparency at the end of it, if you took it to surgery and did a corneal grafting procedure. We are able to fix, most, even if it's corneal ruptures or deep corneal ulcers. When I say most, I always have a very open discussion with the client whether at the end of this procedure, this patient will not only have an eye again, but actually will be able to see through that eye. So it's not uncommon to have a puggerish it too with a complete pan corneal melt with no cornea left whatsoever. And then the advice would be to, probably opt for enucleation rather than trying to fix it if the eye has ruptured. If there's no chance of any sort of corneal clarity at the end of all of this. Other procedures, I think, even just diagnostic procedures. So, an acute onset blindness or even a progressive blindness, we are able to do some diagnostics on doing retinal function tests using an ERG, advanced diagnostic imaging. Same goes for orbital processes. We have all of those facilities. Luckily, we are in a multidisciplinary hospital, so we have got imaging facilities here as well. So we are able to deal with most aspects of ophthalmic disease. The one thing that I do really enjoy about working at Paragon is that we have an excellent oncology service, and in particular eyelid masses or periocular masses which may not be treatable just by an ophthalmologist because the tumor might just be too big to operate on. We do have an oncology service who perform superficial radiation or other treatment options to try and shrink that mass down to a point where we can actually operate it and reconstruct the eyelid or save the eye if necessary. So that is something that I'm very proud to say that we have available. Yeah, I can't think of anything off the top of my head other than that.
I think that kind of falls into what we were talking about earlier, actually, just before we started this podcast, about kind of the full spectrum referral centre when you have a multidisciplinary team. So, you know, it's not being bounced around to different vet practices. Once it's here and there's multiple body systems involved or multiple disciplines involved, they are all here. So it makes, you know, even the most horrific case presentation seem a lot easier when you can pull in expertise from every single field.
Absolutely.
Awesome. I think we're coming into the kind of last few minutes of this podcast now. So I think what we should do now is a kind of a bit of a quick fire. What, in terms of kind of common conditions with the eye, and when you see them in histories when they come here, what tweaks would you make to certain treatments? I mean, you've already mentioned with corneal ulcers, adding in the serum drops. Conjunctivitis, what would you like to see people doing more of when we're treating those? Do you want us to be doing intraocular pressures just to make sure we're not missing anything? You know, what sort of things would you tweak about the way first opinion practices approach the eye, for example?
Yeah. So conjunctivitis is actually a good example for that. If I have a cat, I'm more likely to accept that she might have primary conjunctivitis, because infectious conjunctivitis, herpes virus related, chlamydia mycoplasma is much more common. In dogs, at least in when I see cases which have been referred for conjunctivitis, I will have a big differential list I want to rule out before concluding that this is just purely conjunctivitis. So, you know, many, many things can look like conjunctivitis. Uveitis can look like it, you know, in some stages, glaucoma, you know, all of these different diseases you want to rule out. And you do need to be able to perform a comprehensive ophthalmology exam, as well as if you're able to do a tonometry in your practice. More and more first opinion vets have access to tonometers nowadays, and can measure intraocular pressures. As long as you're comfortable and familiar with the machine, you should be able to get reliable results. But you do need to acquaint yourself with the machine, rather than just using it, you know, here and there, here, now and again.
Yeah, I think that's one of the risks of it. Is if it's there, you're just going to have a stab at it and just have a quick look at the instruction manual and then jab it in the eye. Yeah,
exactly.
Particularly with the tonneau pens, they're a bit more risky compared to the
tonneau vets.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. I mean, that's not, you know, not to say that we're sponsored by tonneau vet or anything, but absolutely. Lastly, in terms of we often talk about kind of here at Paragon is definitely a cutting edge facility. But in terms of what we do in first opinion practice, which is kind of, you know, industry standard, you know, basic veterinary medicine when it comes to the eye, what would you change about when we come to a diagnostic pathway, when we look at an eye, what would you want us to do at every step to make sure we have a full investigation of any eye problem, you know, starting from fundic exam to a tonneau pen? What would you do first? What would you then do? And what would you finish on?
The order of the eye exam.
Order of the eye exam. Yeah.
Okay. So when I see a dog for an eye exam, it's basically, I always go through the same procedure. So every time I see a case, I try to do the same things again. I start off by doing a distant eye examination, checking their menace and dazzle responses, PLR responses. The one thing I think that's underutilized is Schirmer tear test. So dry eye disease is a very, very common condition. I shouldn't see a single dry eye case, an undiagnosed dry eye case in referral practice, because it is a very easy diagnosis to make, especially if they're lacking the quantity of the tear film. I think the qualitative types of dry eye is a bit more harder to diagnose. But yes, so dry eye disease is a very, very common condition. So I think that's a test that you should employ in every animal that you bother to look at the eye. The one tool that I could not live without is my slit lamp. I think everything else I could do without. I can even live without an ophthalmoscope or a tonometer. I can use my phone to work as a direct ophthalmoscope. I can even use my slit lamp if I hold it very close to my eyes as an ophthalmoscope. But my slit lamp is one of the most important tools that I would not want to exist without. It does give you that magnification. It gives you the option to have an optical cross section through the transparent media of the eye. It is just a very, very important tool. The one thing, if you have a slit lamp in your practice or about to purchase one, is don't go for a cheap, crappy one. It is a bit like driving a car. If you drive a cheap and crappy car, you're not going to enjoy the ride. If you invest into something which is a bit more advanced, then you will get more joy and you get more information out of them. So that is definitely something that that I would encourage anybody who's interested in ophthalmology to get. So I do a complete eye exam with my slit lamp of the anterior segment, starting from the outside of the eyelids, cornea, anterior chamber, all the way to the back of the lens. Then I use an indirect ophthalmoscope to have a look at the back of the eye. And then I finish off by doing tonometry and fluorescein staining in every case. So I think fluorescein stain is part of a general eye exam. And then depending on if they need any additional procedures or examinations performed, such as gonioscopy or ocular ultrasonography or ERG.
That's fantastic. Brilliant. Well, I think that's everything we've got time for today. I think that we've managed to fit quite a lot into what would be kind of the average commute to a vet practice. So hopefully you'll either just be getting to work at this point or hopefully just getting home. So thank you, James, for being with us today. And yes, any feedback you want on this podcast or any topics you want to see us do in the future, please just email them in to Paragon. The email is on the website. And I hope you have a great rest of your day.
Thank you very much.
Cheers now.